Today, we conclude our series on rivals to the Wright brothers. Last week, we visited the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, where the 1903 Wright brothers flyer is on display. This is the plane Orville and Wilbur flew at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, on December 17, 1903. The flyer has been suspended from the museum's ceiling for 55 years, but for the centennial, it has been moved to eye level to give visitors a new perspective. The Wright brothers achieved their first goal, powered, controlled flight, but the next task was less romantic, getting a patent and developing their invention. As difficult as it was to get to this point, the road ahead would be just as hard and considerably more stressful. In recent weeks, we've concentrated on those who were trying to be the first in the air. The most well-known was Samuel Pierpont Langley, the director of the Smithsonian a century ago. His aerodrome, backed with government money, plunged into the Potomac River in both of its trials, the last just a week before the Wright brothers were ready for their attempt. The aerodrome would return, though, years later, in the hands of the man who became the Wright's biggest competitor. One floor below the Wright Flyer, there's an exhibit called Early Flight. One of the aircraft displayed is the Model D Headless Pusher, first built in 1909 by Glenn Hammond Curtis. Curtis was running a bicycle shop when the Wright brothers first flew, but that would all change when he met one of the giants of American technology.
Among the many people who were very interested in early flight was Alexander Graham Bell. You know, if it hadn't been for his early success with the telephone, he probably would have devoted much of his energy to trying to make a working airplane.
Seth Shulman is the author of Unlocking the Sky, Glenn Hammond Curtis and the Race to Invent the Airplane. Bell was drawn to Curtis by horsepower.
Curtis moved from making bicycles to making motorcycles and arguably made the best lightweight motors of his day.
Motors that could be used to power an airplane. In 1907, Bell formed a group called the Aerial Experiment Association, or AEA. There were five members, including Curtis, who became its director.
And this group was just absolutely a phenomenal collection of guys who, within the space of 5 months, got an airplane off the ground. It's amazing to see the amount of work that they were doing so quickly to make a lot of decisions about how best to get an airplane to fly.
The Wright brothers had captured the title of first in flight 4 years earlier, but they were more concerned with securing a patent than showing off their machine.
The thing that people forget is that not too many people really knew about the Wright brothers' flight. They refused to publicly demonstrate their airplane for a full 4.5 years after that Kitty Hawk flight. And so while newspaper reports had come out to some extent and there were rumors about it, no one had actually seen it. Even after the Wright brothers got their patent, there was still a period of some 2 years where they were still unwilling to demonstrate their airplane. And it's kind of a big mystery of history, what they were thinking. We know at the time that they were trying to secure big contracts with some government for their technology.
While the Wrights waited, each of the AEA members got a chance to experiment with a craft. Curtis called his craft the Junebug. He tried to tackle the problem of lateral stability, a decision that would color the next decade of his life.
That became the core of the lawsuit that went on for some 9 years between Glenn Curtis and the Wright brothers and became very bitter. And what the dispute was about is that the Wright brothers solved this problem of stability in the air. And they did it by actually bending the wings. They called it wing warping. By twisting the wings in flight, it allowed the plane to bank on a turn without keeling over. The solution that the AEA, the Aerial Experiment Association, came up with was to actually put flaps on the back of a rigid wing. They hadn't figured out yet that it was the best place to put them was probably behind the wing, so they were sitting out these little extra wings, these little triangles out on the edge of the wings. And the wings were also curved. The top ones were kind of curved down and the bottoms were curved up. The other thing that's very notable about it is that it had a tricycle landing gear. And the AEA were among the very first to use wheels on the bottom of the plane. This was the plane that flew July 4th, 1908. That was the first plane that most anybody in America saw fly, and it was quite a sensation.
Almost 100 years later, the question of whether the AEA's ailerons infringed on the Wright brothers' patent still arouses passion and controversy. Wright historian James Tobin.
I'm supposed to be an unbiased historian, but I acknowledge that I'm something of a partisan of the Wrights in this whole thing. So I'll say that essentially Glenn Curtis and Alexander Graham Bell stole the Wrights' idea for how to balance an aircraft. They modified the actual device that was used instead of using the wing-warping device that the Wrights had thought of. They used ailerons, which turned out to be a somewhat more efficient technique. And the Wrights sued them, saying that this was an infringement on their patent, and in a series of court battles, the Wrights were victorious in each case.
Curtis biographer Seth Shulman sees it differently.
I think the broad answer is essentially what you see in a lot of stories out of the history of technology. There's sort of two ways you can go with technology. You either take a kind of an open route and you share your technology, or you take a closed route, which is what the Wright brothers were pursuing. And if you do that, you really need to protect the core of the emerging technology, or try to. And the Wright brothers made no bones about the fact that their business plan is that they sought a monopoly on the airplane. After all, this is still the age of monopoly. And so the core of the lawsuit was that they had secured this broad patent, kind of absurdly broad patent. I'm not sure whether it would even be issued today. But on the basis of that, they essentially contended that you could not make a functioning airplane without infringing their patent. And that was the case that they took pretty much all the way up to the Supreme Court.
The patent fight stretched on for 9 years, but Curtis, through appeals and other legal tactics, kept working. In 1908, Wilbur Wright finally publicly demonstrated the flyer in France to great acclaim. Curtis continued on his own. He won a major competition in Rennes, France. The Wrights weren't there, but three of their planes were flown. Finally, in 1909, Glenn Curtis and Wilbur Wright were scheduled to fly at the same event, the Hudson Fulton Celebration in New York. James Tobin.
This was one of these great sort of World's Fair type exhibitions. The big event was to be these aviation expositions. And nobody had ever flown in a city before, and nobody had ever sort of tried the kind of tricky winds and turbulence that were present in the sky over a place like New York City. So this attracted an awful lot of attention in the papers, quite rightly. Here were these two rivals. Everybody knew that they were in court against each other, both invited to fly in front of enormous crowds. Curtis, after claiming that he would fly around the Statue of Liberty and make spectacular flights, was too afraid of the turbulence and the wind in New York Harbor to make a flight. He had a plane that he hadn't tested before, and he was just too nervous to do it. And Wilbur Wright, who was not known as a showman or a self-promoter, in one sort of great act of showmanship, made the flights that Curtis had been supposed to make, flew around the Statue of Liberty, and then, with about a million people watching, flew all the way up the west side of Manhattan to Grant's tomb and all the way back down again. First time New York City had seen an airplane fly. And this is really the culmination of all of Wilbert's efforts to not only to build an airplane, but to really achieve his realization as a great figure. He knew that he had it in him, and this was sort of the realization of his destiny.
But Glenn Curtis wasn't finished. Seth Shulman.
Curtis comes back again, still embroiled in this lawsuit, in May of 1910, and makes an absolutely earth-shattering flight from Albany to Manhattan, a 150-mile flight over uncharted terrain along the Hudson River. This is the first real flight from one American city to another, and really did more in some ways than almost anything prior, certainly in America, to make people realize that the airplane was more than just a fabulous toy. And just to give you a sense of what a sensation that later 1910 flight was, it garnered some 6 full pages of text and photos in the New York Times. I believe it's more than they ever devoted to a single news item.
In 1912, Wilbur Wright died of typhoid fever. Some of the Wright family blamed the patent fight for wearing him out. They also weren't happy when 2 years later, Glenn Curtis talked to the Smithsonian about resurrecting Samuel Langley's aerodrome. James Tobin.
Curtis was still fighting his legal battles. He had lost a key part of his lawsuit and hoped to resurrect his chances by showing that the Wrights had not built the first machine that could actually fly. They had been awarded what's called a pioneer patent, sort of a milestone patent that said that they had invented a whole new technology. Curtis felt that if he could challenge that claim, he could undermine the Wrights' other claims. And so with the agreement of officials, the highest officials at the Smithsonian, brings Langley's old machine back out of mothballs and rebuilds it, claiming not to have made any modifications in it, and then was able to fly it. In fact, it was clearly documented that he had made modifications to it, that he had strengthened the aerodrome, and he was able to get off the water for a short hop. And this was not rewarded. I mean, he did not. He was not able to make any hay with this, and he quickly moved away from it. But it did start a long, very acrimonious battle between Orville Wright, the only surviving brother at that point, and the successive secretaries of the Smithsonian.
The argument with the Smithsonian was over signs. When the institution displayed Samuel Langley's aerodrome, the sign said it was the first machine capable of sustained flight. Orville was incensed by the Smithsonian's seeming unwillingness to give the Wright brothers full credit for having invented the airplane. He wanted the flyer displayed here, but not under those circumstances. In 1928, as a gesture of protest, he loaned the 1903 flyer to the Science Museum in London. After 14 years, the Smithsonian finally relented, and the Wright flyer came back to Washington. When World War I began, the U.S. government ordered the nation's two largest airplane companies to settle their differences. A cross-licensing agreement was worked out, and the long, bitter lawsuit was over. In 1929, the two companies merged into the Curtis Wright Corporation. Curtis's company had been much larger and much more successful than the Wrights. Orville remained bitter until the end of his life. But the talent and huge accomplishments of Glenn Hammond Curtis cannot be denied. Seth Shulman.
Curtis probably deserves even more credit than the Wright brothers for helping to bring a modern airplane into reality. All those 500 seminal innovations, things like the enclosed cockpit and retractable landing gear and aileron flaps on the wings, these things are still on most airplanes today. The Wright brothers, their plane was virtually entirely obsolete by around 1912, and they never really brought it into the future at a time when things were changing. You have in these guys the fantastic innovator in Curtis, who just kept improving things and figuring a better way of doing things, and the Wright brothers who solved that initial puzzle and stuck with it at a time when people were still so skeptical. You need both. Unfortunately, in this story, the two were at bitter odds with one another, and it makes for really quite an interesting and much richer tale about how we got an airplane than what you usually learn in grade school.
Ample credit is finally shared at the Smithsonian on this centennial of the Wright brothers' first flight. Last Monday, the Smithsonian opened the Udvar-Hazy Center, an extension of the Air and Space Museum that showcases hundreds of aircraft and spacecraft. Seven Curtis planes are on view there, two Curtis Wright planes, and Samuel Langley's great aerodrome. If you'd like more information on Glenn Hammond Curtis and the Wright brothers, and to see a photo gallery, visit our website at npr.org.